Just go ahead and just talk a little bit. Hey, I was we're getting some levels while we're just getting the levels before we start, Michael. I saw Frank Stack in the on your I guess on the what was it on the what
the
for the po- the
web, on the podcast, website,
podcast
page,
yeah,
yes,
the podcast
yes.
page, that's right, talking about the spider cereal. And you pointed out that that was the Three Stooges unit that made that cereal, and wasn't
oh,
that
yeah.
Edward Klein that directed it?
I believe that's
Leonard
right.
Eddie
I'd
Klein?
Have to go look up the particulars, but it's what was that last note I dropped back to Frank? Like this is probably the greatest slapstick cereal ever.
Oh, it
made.
Is. Well, they're play. You know, at one point in that, they play the villains play patty cake while they're watching.
Mm-hmm.
The, yeah,
mm-hmm.
And it is. I think it's Edward Klein, if I'm not mistaken, is the director.
Pretty sure you're right, and I'd have to go look all those particulars. George Turner hated that film.
Yeah, a lot of the cereal people don't like it at all.
And George was an old-time cereal loyalist, and he felt they should be grimly serious.
Right, right.
And I said, well, you know, damn, even how Flash Gordon is pretty darn corny. Much as, you know, a heresy, of course.
Sure, but, oh, yeah, yeah. But the Pope people, you know, the Pope people did not like that one because the spider was such a grim, bloody avenger, you know, in the
Pope. As well he should be, and yeah. He gets that treatment in the first serial.
He does indeed, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of amazed me, and I was kind of influenced by George's attitude, but the more I look at the thing, it's like, no, this... It doesn't. They don't have to be a matched set.
No, they don't have to. That's true. And there is just a very different feeling. Are we okay, Joey? You look like we're all right.
Whenever you want to.
All right.
Just get into the
Let's see. And you tell me this every time, but Michael will do the taped introduction.
Yeah, we've done the introduction.
And then I come back and introduce Michael.
Uh-huh. We may at the end of this, we may have Michael re-record an opening.
All right.
Because he talks about. The prior Forgotten Horrors, with, and especially the
right,
if we would talk about the newer one,
okay,
the release,
all right,
and we'll get to that whenever we do. But theoretically, he's going to have he talks about you and he gives lists your credits. So
lists my credits,
you come
okay.
In, he'll just
I'll come mm-hmm. in. All right, okay, we about ready. Here we go. Thank you very much, Michael Price, and the other part of this clam bake. The author of the Forgotten Horrors series, co-author of the Forgotten Horrors series, co-originator of the Forgotten Horrors series, the first two of which are now back in print in amended and updated form, my friend Michael H. Price.
Right back on the same old block with a different batch of stuff to pick through.
That's right, and what we're picking through tonight is Attack of the Crab Monsters, which I had not seen since I was a kid in 1957, and it played.
Well, that
local
must have
theater.
Been a revelation.
Oh my goodness, it scared me to death. I was sitting there watching it. Well, I was watching it with Joey, as a matter of fact, Joey and
uh-huh.
Emily, and the two sailors, which is Beach Dickerson, and I can't remember the other one is Tony Miller, I think.
And I believe that's right.
Yeah, the two sailors are there playing cards, and they look up, and the crab monster is clacking his claws, and I ran dialogue from 1957, where he
wow.
sounds like a kid running the stick over a picket fence, And the second one says, but we ain't got a picket fence, and they get up and run out. That had been indelibly burned into my brain in 1957, and Joey was suitably impressed, I think.
Because both of us as kids ran lots of sticks over lots of picket fences.
That's probably true. You know, one of the things that I'm learning as I, you know, in everything you see things with fresh eyes, and as you get older, and I really am seeing Charles Griffith's work as something really special.
It's amazing how some fondly remembered pieces from such times gone by don't hold up at all.
Yes.
While others not only hold up, but gain resonance and relevance in a way that one would never have expected. I keep having those adventures trying to go back and rediscover the childish delights of Gardner Fox's comic book scripts.
Right.
The Flash, for example. And Julius Schwartz, the very effective comic book editor, his titles that he basically improved over many of their companion titles from the same company. And I'm amazed at how juvenile, infantile in some cases, and condescending these beloved, you know, Flash, whatever, Adam Strange, and especially Julie Schwartz's condescending attitude toward the reader. And how they, like, I keep wanting them to hold up because that was a favorite activity as in childhood. And they don't, and yet you go back to something like Roger Corman's and Charles Griffith's Attack of the Crab Monsters, and it's like, wow, was this film subversive or what?
There's something going on there that of course, was not necessarily meant for kids. But as I think as you get older, and certainly in my case, you think more about the afterlife and all of this. And I mean, this film begins with a quote from Genesis, and it is almost about, to me, it's almost a meditation in some ways. And I don't want to, obviously, we're talking about a low-budget programmer here and all of that, but it still is a part of it is a kind of a meditation on life after death.
Well, yeah, it's got that distinct vibration, or where does the, not only the intellect, but also the soul, where do those elements go?
Exactly, yeah.
Like, wait a minute, you mean when you croak, your soul goes into a giant crab?
And the soul would have to be there because their essence was there, you know?
Right, and which is not, of course, not what Griffith is saying, but he is positing the fact that the transference of the soul, whether through scientific or metaphysical means, might not only be possible, but also likely.
Yes, that's
very,
right.
Very, very strange, and of course, the beauty of the Corman troupe of actors is that he had a lot of people with great radio voices, whose dynamic recitation, of course, Griffith himself had a background in radio.
Right.
Your artists like Mel Wells, like... well, Richard Garland, for example, Pamela Duncan, and on down into the larger extended stock company. I mean, Corman had a stock company long before Woody Allen even dreamed of himself as a movie maker.
Absolutely.
And they all had great voices that would leave an impression the sometimes lacking photography and special effects might fail. And nowhere in the Corman body of work is that more evident than in Crab Monsters, where so much of it is done by these great radio voices without much physical presence.
Right, because the voices are being transmitted from crabs. So you don't have a lot of physical presence. Well, for folks who don't know, The movie in Shout Factory has got a nice, that's the print that we watched, it's got a very nice DVD of it. It's about a group of scientists who come onto an island that has been swept by radioactive cloud, and they're looking for scientists who'd been sent out there earlier, and there's no sign of them whatsoever. And they set up on this island, and they soon find out that the radiation has mutated these crabs into gigantic crabs who can eat you and maintain basically your vocal cords. And as you say, your soul by inference. And the rest of it is a fight, really, with Richard Garland and Pamela Duncan and Russell Johnson, who I talked to back in the early 90s, when he was the first one of the Gilligan's Island cast to write a book. And I think it was Here on Gilligan's Isle was the name of it. And I remember interviewing him for the Tulsa World newspaper, and we got to talking about Roger Corman, and kind of postulated if Johnson hadn't gotten Gilligan's Island, he might have been typecast as a horror and science fiction player. He'd done some Twilight Zones, he'd done This Island Earth, he'd done Attack of the Crab Monsters, and basically he talked about how cheap Roger Corman was, which is what most of the people who worked for Roger Corman did. But it's very funny, and Joey pointed this out when we were watching it. The Russell Johnson's character does pretty much what the professor character did on Gilligan's Island. I mean, he's like almost building radio receivers out of coconuts. You know, he's always working on things. He's always working on electricity. It's almost like somebody from Gilligan's Island had the shot of him on a deserted island fixing a radio transmitter, had that subliminally in their heads, and when it came time to cast the professor, cast Russell Johnson as the professor.
Which would make Gilligan's Island the sequel to Attack of the Crab Monsters.
Wouldn't you love to see the next Gilligan's Island film be a mashup of those two pictures?
Wow.
You have Gilligan's Island meet the Crab Monsters? That would be great.
What would Jim Backus make of this?
How'd you like to have a crab speaking in the Thurston Howell's voice? That would be great.
Well, I was thinking maybe more the voice of Mr. Magoo.
That's true.
What a ghastly fantasy.
Well, you know, but Gilligan's Island will eventually be remade at some point, probably as a big-screen feature. And it'd be nice to throw some giant crabs in there. I don't think it'll happen, but, you know, we can dream.
That's kind of why... I think most people watch movies, which is as close to watching somebody else's dream as you'll ever get.
That's exactly right. Well, I wanted to just a couple of technical things that I didn't know until after I watched the film. Beach Dickerson, who really is kind of an unsung member of Corman's troupe. You know, he was around with Corman for a long time in various capacities. A lot of times he was behind the camera. But this portrayal he gives of this sailor, to me, is very much like what he did in Creature from the Haunted Sea, which I think is another brilliant Corman picture.
He played
the same kind of a character. But he also, apparently, he and Ed Nelson, who's one of the survivors in the picture, because he's the ensign that in charge of the crew that brings the scientists to the island.
Right.
Ed Nelson and Beach Dickerson apparently ran the crabs. Beach Dickerson, or Crab, I think there was actually only one. Beach Dickerson did the claws, and I guess Ed Nelson did the rest of it.
Typical of the Corman company, everybody does double and triple duty.
Right, right.
And the special effects are so very special in the sense that you don't get them every 5 seconds.
Yes.
That they are organic as opposed to synthetic. It's probably Corman's effects shop should not be mentioned in the same breath with Ray Harryhausen.
No.
But in their respective quality or lack thereof, each is a handmade process.
Right.
The crabs, you know, they scared me when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And watching the restoration recently, well, that is a crisp digital restoration.
It's a beautiful restoration.
That the Shot Factory has put together. Watching that restoration recently, it's like, okay, I don't feel the urge to cover my eyes when these things are approaching, but the premise is still scary.
It is still scary, and I don't think that the goofiness of the crabs and the way that they look really takes very much away from that. I think you buy into that whole vision.
Well, crabs are goofy looking by nature in the first place, so I watched a Pete Smith's 3D specialty the other night, one of those short subjects with the 3D gimmick that, mm-hmm. that MGM did.
Back about in the 30s, right?
One of the visual gags involves some kid shoving a crab, a writhing crab, in the face of the viewer. And it's like, that is so silly. And so, of course, crabs are silly-looking creatures. I guess except if one's bearing down on you from a high vantage and threatening to devour you.
Or a giant crab.
A giant crab that has the ability to absorb your intellect and very being.
And that's really what it does, because it's not just it's manipulating the voices, but it's clearly the people that are calling to the cast members that haven't died yet. I think when I look back, I'm not so sure that wasn't the creepiest part of it to me. You know, someone, and I think it was, who was the guy who directed Slither just recently? It's been 6 or 7 years now. But a very underrated picture and a very underrated director. But I don't think it was James Gunn on Slither. I can't remember who it was. But Slither, there was two Slithers. You know, one was the trailer park thing with James Caan and Sally Kirkland.
Oh yes, that's the one I'm thinking.
Now, this was a horror movie. Slither was kind of a shape shifting alien, and I cannot remember. Was it James Gunn? Joey thinks it was James Gunn. Anyway, mm-hmm. he says that zombie movies, that the whole fear thing in zombie movies is the fear of your loved ones turning against you.
Oh yes, that's the element that distinguishes, say, a George Romero zombie picture from, say, one of the Lucio Fulci things, where the menacing force is about as personal as a tornado.
Right, right. And I think that is the part of the crab monsters that really unnerves me, the people you can't trust. It's like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, the thing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre that's so brilliant is it's basically a chronicle of the death of the hippie movement. You can't trust anything or anybody. You can't trust people who look like you, never mind if they're under 30 or not, and they look like you still can't trust them. You can't trust your food. You can't trust your memory. You can't trust anything. And when something like that happens, again, in Attack of the Crab Monsters, you can't trust the people that you once had to trust because they're kind of a military unit. And, of course, they have to depend on
them. They're kind of a military unit. Their intellects are being absorbed and put to an inappropriate use, that is, by human terms, at least.
And, not by crab terms, though.
And, of course, Corman does that wonderful classic old trick that you've seen in, oh, gosh, you've seen it in King Kong. You've seen it in the nifty little monogram from the post-war 40s called Face of Marble.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, with Carradine, right? Or with, who was in Face of, it's not Carradine, is it? It's
John Carradine and Inspector Henderson, of course.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
but, you know, a flawed film in many respects. Of course, it's got our favorite comedian, Willie Best, for a wonderful bit of trepidation.
Now, you said Inspector, is that Raymond Massey is in it, correct?
No. I'm thinking of, gosh, now you've got me doing it. Robert Shane.
Oh, Robert Shane, of course, yes.
Inspector Henderson.
Yeah, that's right.
Who
from
was,
Batman,
of course,
from the
standby character of Superman.
Mm-hmm.
The element that I'm talking about, you see it in the hotel invasion in King Kong. You see it in the bedroom invasion in Face of Marble. You see it in the voice in the night in Attack of the Crab Monsters. It's that surefire skin crawler of the intrusion in privacy.
Mm-hmm.
The voice in the dead of night, the telephone call at 3 a.m., the rattling at the window when you think it might be the branches of a tree, but it might not. And it's certainly there in what Griffith and Corman did with crab monsters.
Disturbing the peace, disturbing tranquility.
Yes, the disturbance of the disturbance of the individual's repose in the privacy of the bedchamber.
Oh, very nice. I never thought
about
it. That's right.
What a creepy premise that withstands all manner of problematical special effects. Of course, we learned a long time ago not to judge a film by its title or by its budget.
Right.
My anti-favorite among the critics' favorites to deploy is, well, this movie looks like it cost about $1.99 to make. And it's like, that doesn't even say anything. Doesn't say a thing. Of course it looks cheap. That was the point. Make them cheap, attach a lurid title that will attract the rubes, and then stick in a subversive narrative pivot that might send them away scratching their heads or might send them away thinking about bigger ideas.
Well, which Griffith did again and again. I mean, he did it in Little Shop of Horrors. He did it in Bucket of Blood. He does it in Attack of the Crab Monsters as a script writer. He's a little bit, again, like Beach Dickerson. I think he's one of the Corman people that maybe is a little lowballed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what a guy that Griffith, and he wrote, I think he wrote probably the best Corman films.
Did he write Death Race 2000?
Death Race 2000.
I believe he did, yeah.
Maybe not the classiest Corman films.
Right.
The ones that look more sumptuous, the ones that take full advantage of the color palette and the widescreen capabilities. Of course, a lot of the cheesier Corman pictures are in really great widescreen.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, Griffith, Creature from the Haunted Sea, for example, Beast from Haunted Cave, that brilliant put down of the pseudo-intellectual movement called A Bucket of Blood.
Absolutely. Dick Miller's greatest moment, I think.
Dick Miller's greatest moment indeed, and everywhere he goes. Actually, I think his second greatest moment is really a cameo in another smart Griffith Corman picture called Not of This Earth.
Oh, yes. As the vacuum cleaner salesman.
Yes.
Of course,
Griffith had credentials, really, literally, have outlived him in the revival of Death Race 2000 and, the year following the author's death.
Right, and, of course, Little Shop of Horrors, which I seem to remember reading something. He really didn't get much money, if anything, out of Broadway and the musical revival and all of that stuff.
No. That was the problematical thing about the Corman corporate interests. They were kind of lax about maintaining copyrights.
Right. That's right. Little Shop of Horrors, because I think it was because it was a film group. I'm not sure if any of those film group movies, that company's movies, I guess they were registered, but were never...
never properly filed for renewal.
Yes.
or maintenance, copyright.
Yes.
Maintenance.
That's right.
And as a result, a lot of the Cormans lapsed into public domain, and Griffith's stake in the film with the film, lapsing into PD, public domain.
That's right. And, of course, Griffith probably never made much money off of it.
Yeah, it's like, give this guy, not only give him some respect, but give him some money.
Mm-hmm.
What a concept.
Right.
Griffith, you find Griffith's smartness and his playful subversiveness in pictures you'd never expect to see it. Ronnie Howard's debut picture was written by Griffith.
Eat My Dust.
The rude hot rod movie that forever changed Hollywood's opinion of little Opie Taylor.
That's right. Well, you know,
wow, you mean he can do this? Well, let's give him something bigger next time.
Well, when Opie Taylor was still charming people on the Andrew Griffith Show, and we were watching these Corman films at the theater, I believe, well, I know that Not of This Earth and Crab Monsters were put together on a double bill, and that was one of Sam Arkoff's big changes and big successes, mm-hmm. was to take two what would have been thought of as B pictures and put them in a double feature that had generally been an A picture and a B picture. He took two B pictures and did that, and B budget pictures and did that. But even back when the Andy Griffith Show was going on, late 50s, early 60s, and before Opie ever did Eat My Dust, you know, I knew, even when I'm 57, I would have been 8 years old. I knew, mm-hmm. even at that age, that there was something different about these Roger Corman films. They weren't plotted, or the characters weren't like. It was like, you know, the old joke was with American International was that they the exhibitors said, well, that they would take the Nicholson, I guess, James Nicholson, the co-owner of the company, was very good about coming up with titles. And coming up with ad campaigns and all of that. And then once they had it pre-sold, then they made the film. Well, the old joke was that the exhibitors said, why don't they put sprocket holes on the publicity material and throw the film away? But the thing that it did was it gave them a certain amount. It was like Edgar Omer working for PRC. Within certain strictures, if they could bring a film in for a certain amount of money and deliver the horror goods or whatever, they could say and do whatever they wanted to.
That's right.
And it was very, very different. Those pictures are different. They're structured differently. I'm not sure, you know, in film school they teach that Act 1, Act 2, and Act 3. I'm not sure if that applies to the
Corman really pictures. Didn't get into the conventional narrative structure until he started adapting Edgar Allan Poe.
That's correct. I would say
in the early 60s.
Yeah.
Of course, he didn't have in his company until Vincent Price and similarly capable players. His company consisted of people who were more attuned to making things up as they went along.
Mm-hmm.
The dream logic, of which Griffith was a master.
Yes, he was.
And the sense that I especially like about Corman's pictures is, like, we've got nothing to lose, so let's go for broke and use audacity in the place of big budgets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those films are, more than anything else, audacious, and they inspired maybe not a huge number of imitators, but they also encouraged that it's linear narrative, but it's not conventional linear narrative.
It's not conventional at all. No,
it does follow an arc,
mm-hmm.
Including the classic comeuppance for the perpetrator, as in, well, say, Dick Miller in A Bucket of Blood.
Right.
Even though he's not a conventional perpetrator.
That's true.
But it's like he pretty much gets what's coming to him, just like Laird Kroeger, the great bad man at Fox in the 40s, gets what's coming to him, or Claude Rains in The Invisible Man, or what have you. But it's like, this is not a noble figure. He's more like an idiot savant.
Well, when I really snapped to that, I think, as far as, and I remember just, I don't know if I said, could even discern that it was Corman, although I probably could when I was 8 or 9 years old.
Sure.
But I guess it would be 1960, so I would have been 11, and I believe it's 60, and it was actually a Gene Corman film, but it was a Film Group movie.
Film Group was the umbrella company that embraced both Corman's efforts for American International and for Allied Artists.
And then he would release some occasionally under that title as a release.
Film Group, yes.
Yeah, under the Film Group. And that's where I saw Beast from Haunted Cave. When Beast from Haunted Cave, and that's a Gene Corman film. Roger's brother Gene produced that one. But as I remember it, it has, for a group of people at the very beginning, they're either fleeing from a bank robbery or something. It's a group of real lowlifes, and you didn't really get that in B pictures in that era, because they were the protagonists. And I thought, boy, there's right. This is just not the kind of storytelling I was used to with B or A pictures. There was something completely different.
There was something despicable.
Yes. And it was something raggedy, too. And something...
They were not even ostensibly classy gangsters like you'd see in the Warner Brothers and Fox Chronicles.
No. And they were raggedy, and because they kind of violated what you were used to seeing, you were kept on edge throughout the whole picture wondering what other conventions they were going to violate. Mm-hmm. That they could do just about anything, and you wouldn't know it. And so your attention was just wrapped throughout the 65, 70 minutes, whether it was Ski Troop Attack or Mighty Atlas, or I think it was just called Atlas with Michael Forrest. And,
sure,
and
yeah.
Those pictures.
And, of course, that's the Corman family, Roger, Gene, and their associates. A great many other talents involved, but they all absorbed that Roger Corman lesson, don't ever let it get boring.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's scarcely a wasted second in a Corman film. Now, you look at some of the shabbier companies that tried to emulate or even imitate the Corman formula, and they will bog down in things like unnecessary exposition, a little bit too much stock footage for padding. Even when a Corman picture is sitting still, now I call to mind that certain favorite that he kind of ghost handled early in his career, the Beast with a Million Eyes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Even when a Corman picture is more or less just sitting there, there's an idea bubbling under the surface.
Which is what makes any kind of literature, whether it's film or literature, whatever, which is what really makes it, gives it resonance and gives it depth and texture and makes it
uh-huh.
worthwhile. And maybe that's why, again, we never want to oversell. I mean, this is a film called Attack of the Crab Monsters, and that's what it is. Well, I mean, we're not talking about Proust here, but there is something going on in these pictures and in Attack of the Crab Monsters that's worth looking into.
That's definitely worth looking into, and it's probably worth over-intellectualizing and maybe over-dignifying.
Well, I hope so, because I think we've done both of those things. So I hope that's the truth.
Well, it's, you know, what Conan Doyle said it best. He said this to those who seek art wherever they can find it, some of the best examples can be found in the shabbiest forms of entertainment. Not his exact words, but very close.
And it's fairly close to what Noel Coward said about music, how potent cheap music is.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same, yeah. That's exactly
and
the same
it's
sort of
the
thing.
Kind of, it's the kind of work made by artists who really have nothing to lose. They don't have patrons to please. They do not have a loyal public except that which they build.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a lot of pandering going on. There's not a lot of reinforcement of the status quo. Sometimes you wonder whether the normalcy that most classic horror films seek is worth regaining.
Right. They're maverick in their way, and I think, again, it's because it's just like Edgar Ulmer at PRC. They could bring in an exploitable title that they knew would play for a certain amount of money, and within those strictures, within that 60, 65 minutes, they could explore ideas if they wanted to. They could do anything they wanted, or they could just crank it right out.
They did
a combination of all of those things, you know.
Eddie Ulmer and Corman were very much of the same cloth.
I think so. I think you're right. And again, I think it's, if you write do an exploitation film, it doesn't have to be devoid of ideas. And Corman, I think maybe when I first snapped to that was in the 70s, when the at the height of the drive-in era, and was watching those like student nurses and films that Corman was making, and how,
yeah.
I mean, they had this huge liberal feminist agenda. As long as some starlet popped her top about every 15 minutes and they blew somebody up or shot somebody every 10 minutes, they could say anything they wanted to.
That's right, exactly. And you look at the Cormans that have followed up into the present day, and I'm specifically talking about those giant monster pictures he's been making lately for the Sci-Fi Channel,
yes.
Cable television.
Yes,
they're not just about hideous, gigantic monsters laying waste to civilization. They're about renegade science. They're about corrupt military interests. Specifically, well, case in point, you've seen Sharktopus, I'll bet.
I have not seen it.
With
not having cable or satellite television being one of the ride free or die 1%, I haven't seen the sci-fi.
Well, channel. you're in for a treat. I should think not too long from now, because it spreads like. Okay. And of course, these are cheesy pictures. Of course, these are exploitation films, but I. You know, short of maybe a Mike Nichols film, you're not going to see such an indictment of the establishment.
Right. And if there's one thing Corman pictures have always been, they have not been establishment pictures. You know, I really think that. And so I would recommend that folks see it, Attack of the Crab Monsters. Again, we don't want to over-intellectualize it or over-hype it. But it's, if you haven't seen it for a long time, if you're an old monster bopper like I am and you haven't seen it since you were a kid, it's worth another look.
That's the and the beauty. I should have perhaps oversell the new DVD edition. The beauty of these recent Corman editions on DVD is that they not only reproduce the widescreen dimensions, but they also have little samples from the television syndicate,
yes,
prints of the 1960s,
that they had,
which is
had.
Where I, for some reason, I missed Crab Monsters in the theaters, but I did catch it when it showed up on syndicated television in the early 60s, and I was always fascinated by those kind of Reader's Digest prologues that they slapped on.
Generally, they just take a scene from the picture,
uh-huh,
and not necessarily one of the more exciting scenes either. Whatever would work, and I think in Crab Monsters, it's her getting up, Pamela Duncan getting up out of bed, and in the one of the scenes you're talking about, and listening to, mm-hmm, the voices outside, and then they have this
intrusion in the bedchamber.
Yeah, and then they have this prologue crawl that takes up another minute or two, just to, mm-hmm, pad it to. I think they had to have 70 minutes or something like that.
It was designed to fit a syndicated television time slot.
90 minutes, probably.
And those crawls, all was like, why not just show the picture?
Right, exactly.
And yet, what does one remember most from such experiences? One remembers the thing that caused a bit of impatience and irritation to get on with the show. And I was so tickled to see that synopsis or prologue crawl on the DVD edition. It was like, gosh, this takes me right back to the living room with my folks. and of course, the voice from the background saying, "Son, when are you going to quit watching that juvenile
That's
trash?"
Right. That's right.
And all the little accoutrements that come with growing up in the thrall of such over-imaginative entertainment.
That's right. That's right. And it does. So you're
nice
absolutely
work.
Right. All right, let's take care of a little bit of business. First of all, I do want to get out the fact that we still have, and for the foreseeable future will have, Forgotten Horrors number 5 for sale, as well as Forgotten Horrors Comics and Stories.
Comics and Stories, that's the first Forgotten Horrors graphic novel.
That's right.
And is it a humdinger?
It is a humdinger, and we'd like to see it move a little bit. So if you've been thinking about getting it, now's the time. And also, where you and I, of course, are getting very close to finishing another Forgotten Horrors to the nth degree, which takes a lot of our, actually all of our columns from Fangoria over the years, or Forgotten Horrors columns, and as well as a lot of new material. I've got an 8,000-word appreciation of David Friedman, our friend,
mm-hmm,
David Friedman.
David Friedman, bless his soul.
Bless
as a matter of fact, I've got the new book, Forgotten Horrors to the Nth Degree, sitting right here on the computer screen.
Excellent.
And doing the tweaks. We just got in a really nice afterword from Steve Bissett.
Wonderful.
Among many other accomplishments, the lead artist slot on the excellent run that Swamp Thing had in the early 1980s.
That's right. That's right. But that's not out yet, and we should mention that the big thing that you just launched is the revamping of Forgotten Horrors 2, which you put the Forgotten Horrors 1 revamp out, what, 6 months ago or so? 3 months
about
ago?
About 6 months ago. Volume 2 is just made its debut a few weeks ago at Amazon.com.
And what have you done? What have you done differently in number two? What kind of things have you done to beef it up?
Added titles.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite as many titles as needed to be added to volume one. I mean, we keep pronouncing these projects done, and then the next thing you know, you've found a bunch of stuff you wish you had known about.
Sure.
So what's to do but keep bringing things up to date? Volume two is not as exhaustive an overhaul, but it is a significant overhaul. I keep thinking, why didn't we include what, fill in the blank, for example, the mysterious Miss X in the first edition? Well, because we looked at it and said, it's kind of iffy, and then you see things through different eyes as time goes by.
Absolutely.
The opinions generally hold. The facts might need a little tweaking once in a while because you gain not only perception, but also interpretation of known facts.
Right, that's true.
And of course, we've gone to great pains to beef up the art to an alarming extent.
Now, we should also mention the Forgotten Horrors CD. That is out, correct?
The Music of Forgotten Horrors CD is now in print at Amazon.
Okay, very good. And
that's the scoring cues from the old Poverty Row spookers. And where did that come from? Well, it's been floating around in that very strange public domain zone.
What they used to call
longer than one cares to remember. And it's like, well, what? I never heard that melody before. So, oh, yes, you have. If you've ever watched a movie from the Poverty Row sector of old Hollywood, you've probably heard at least half these musical cues.
At least half.
Of course, the beauty is they weren't composed for specific films.
That's right. They were
composed and recorded and then rented to the studios. Okay, here's a spooky theme. Drop the needle on that groove.
That's what they used to call needle drop. Needle drop soundtracks.
Drop scoring. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like where you didn't have a composer or a conductor or an orchestra, you had the ability to rent phonograph records containing the music your film needed.
Right.
And boy, you know, they didn't call them Poverty Row for nothing.
That's right. Well, let's give two things. Number one, a shout out to Mr. Joe Barlow of Scranton, Pennsylvania, who is our winner this time around of the Hot Shock
Horror. Oh, I love Scranton. They've got one of the best comic book stores in the world in Scranton.
Really?
Comics on the Green.
What's the name of it?
Comics on the Green in
Comics
Scranton,
Green.
PA. Wonderful place.
I'm sure Mr. Barlow has been there. And are you giving away something this time around?
Yes, as a matter of fact. We've got the new spooky comedy CD, Voodoo Killed the Rodeo Star.
Voodoo Killed the Rodeo Star, and that would be Michael H. Price and his musical miscreants? Or
just
who is
sitting there waiting for some either fortunate or strategic listener to glom onto it.
All right. So that'll be the giveaway. The first person that writes it to my website, which is www.johnwooley, johnwooley.com, and says, I want a copy of the Michael Price disc, Voodoo Killed the Rodeo Star. We'll get a copy of that disc, signed or the rare unsigned copy, either way you prefer it.
Or we can just sign the cellophane, and you can rip it off.
That's exactly right. And have the best of both worlds. Michael, thank you very much. We'll be back again. Joey Hambrick, our producer, thank you so much for everything. Are you here?
Yes, I'm
here. You didn't wander off.
Right on
there,
the line.
Right.
Joey
and Emily have been watching the films with me, and I hope that continues. We've been having a really good time watching these Forgotten Horrors pictures. And again, we want to encourage you to take a look at the Forgotten Horrors brand, the books, the disc, and they make wonderful gifts. You know, it's never too early to start buying stuff for Christmas.
Oh, never too early. And let's see. Oh, yes, don't forget the generous updates on the Forgotten Horrors podcast page at Facebook.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Michael. Let's do it again soon.
Always a pleasure.
There we go.
Boy, we're learning to come in right under it now. About 44 minutes. Well, perfect.
Levels good, yeah.
Levels good.
Great. Yeah.
Michael, I think it was terrific.
I think we're on the right track. What else we got?